Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 24th, 2006. Today's session is entitled New Perspectives, New Truths, presented by Paul Olson, number OLP 2006-04. Let's listen in.
My name is Paul, and I'm the teaching staff coordinator here this summer. And I also, in another life, am an English teacher at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. If anybody know about the Augustana College in Sioux Falls? Yeah, that's the other Augustana. That's number two. Yeah, we're number one. You went to Augustana?
No,
but
I did have a
problem. Oh, okay. This is about African-American literature. And as I have to tell students the first time I walk into class is, what is this white? Are you looking for a different section?
It was posted at the Da Vinci Code.
It was originally
You're pasted on top of the Da Vinci Code.
Right.
Only here, though, not on the main board.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
So feel free. Something else.
Feel free to. Though there's a thing on sexuality over with Dr. Bracken, Tom Bracken. Feel free to do that. I won't be offended. What happened is that theologian that's going to do the Da Vinci Code isn't here, and so you get stuck with a sub. But we might have an interesting time. So, but if go ahead if you feel like if you want to do something else, go ahead and do that. And I'll turn around so I won't look. You can just be gone. One of the things I think that requires a brief explanation is that why a white guy from northern Minnesota with Norwegian heritage would be teaching African-American literature. And the shortest answer is I grew up in a little village in Minnesota next to an Indian reservation. And even before I could, well, way before I could ever articulate what I saw as injustice and unfairness and exclusion, I just knew something was wrong. And I went on through high school and left and went to college. And I was in graduate school working on a master, or finished the master's degree and starting on a PhD in American and English literature. And I was sitting in a class, and next to my, at that time, my best friend was a black guy, also just finishing his master's degree, going on for a PhD. And we were good friends because we shot baskets all day and should have been reading, but we weren't. And the teacher referred to Richard Wright. How many people know who Richard Wright is? Most of you do. Well, if you have a master's degree in English, you should know who Richard Wright is. And if you don't know, that's okay. But I should have. And the teacher referred to that, and I leaned to my friend John and said, who's Richard Wright? I'd never heard of him. I had an undergraduate degree in English, a double major, and history, American, lots of American history. You might stumble across that. Then a master's degree at a good university, and had never heard of it. That's institutional racism. And I began to put together my own sense of injustice way back there in this little Minnesota town, and the sense of what literature is good. What literature is the stuff that people say to you, this is what you should read to be to be a college teacher, and I hadn't. Well, that changed my life, and everything spun out of that, and it changed. That's the brief history of that. And it's also kind of the pattern for where we're going to go today. So, enough of that said.
Who is Richard Wright?
Richard Wright is a... You can get a PhD at the University of Oregon. Richard Wright is an African-American writer, probably the most famous, most protesting writer of the 40s and 50s, and a little bit into the 60s. A novelist, mostly. You may have heard of these titles, Native Son, Black Boy, a collection of short stories called Uncle Tom's Children. If you haven't, they're very powerful stories. If you haven't, I would suggest... How many people have heard of The Grapes of Wrath? John Steinbeck. Okay, John Steinbeck, a white guy. I would say... that Richard Wright's Native Son is a better book. At least, I'll just say it's as good. It's as well written, it has as compelling characters, it has powerful themes, and it's a completely different look because it's through the eyes of an African American look at the Depression. So Wright is an important figure, and we're not going to talk about him today, but that's the image that comes up. And if you have any other questions, ask those because I give a quiz, it's on Wednesday. You'll be responsible.
How do you spell the last name?
Wright. And his most famous stuff, and maybe a place to start, is a collection of short stories called Uncle Tom's Children, which comes from that Harriet Beecher Stowe novel in the Civil War, Uncle Tom's cabin, and then so he's writing a collection of stories about the children of Uncle Tom. You know, it's fiction. And then Native Son and Black Boy. Black Boy is his autobiography. Okay, all that said, I'm going to ask you, what are some of your favorite images in all the literature that you've read, including the Bible? And what I mean by an image is, one of my favorite images in the Bible is the shepherd, is lilies of the valley, sparrows, eye of the needle and the camels and that kind of thing. So I'm going to list a couple. So fire away from anything you've read at all, some of the images that you remember or hold dear.
The fiddler on the roof.
Okay.
And it's the fiddler.
Sure. And it's a great image. And we've seen it in the movies. And great. Keep going.
A little house on the prairie.
And give us, okay, well, first we have the little house.
Yeah.
And that becomes an image. And we'll stop there just for a second, and then we'll go faster and let them and not talk about them. But what does the fiddler image carry with it? What do you think of when you see that image?
Tradition.
Okay, all at once.
Tradition.
Oh, we're done. Okay, so that carries with it
balance.
What, balance?
Trying to maintain balance.
Okay, and it's not just balance on the roof, is it?
No.
What's the balance?
Life.
Yeah, great. Well, you guys are... forget the quiz. You're already automatically... little house.
Independence and courage.
Okay. Oh, sure. Courage.
Isolation.
What was that one?
Isolation.
Isolation.
Survival.
With community.
Community.
Survival.
Family.
For sure. Family. That's enough. And more. But the point is, isn't it, that one little image carries a lot of stuff. And I think most of us, you know, take our ideas about our ideas about how we look at life, the values we have in life, and they're carried by these images that get put in front of us again and again and again, whether it's on TV or movies or musicals, or now let's go to the books. Any book at all. It doesn't mean if we read it in common, because we'll get it, but just a couple more images that come to mind. What?
Ragtime.
And give an image. That's the book. What's an image out of that you remember?
Struggle.
That's the theme that comes through. That's great. And what makes you think of the struggle in Ragtime? E.L. Doctorow, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything they had to face just to live a decent life, I guess.
Yep. And can you name one thing?
Courage.
This is a test. You passed already. You got the most important theme here. What would symbolize some kind of... we can go to Ragtime or go anywhere you want to. What would symbolize struggle? You can think biblically if you want to. You can think of just some picture that's the image... What?
Poverty.
Okay, poverty. So let's be specific with that. An image of poverty is an empty plate. I mean, that's what I mean by, okay, is a...
Gleaners.
Huh?
Gleaners.
Yeah, gleaners, biblical. Put it down. Empty plate. Anything else?
Ragged clothes.
Ragged clothes.
Emaciated bodies.
What?
Ignorance.
And ignorance becomes one of those themes that's carried, that creates that, that comes out of the picture that we see. We see this empty plate, and we see the gleaning and ignorance and struggle. And everybody get with me? That we're after these images that are a part of our lives and give shape and order to our lives, carry a lot of how we think and of how we feel and how we live our lives. Okay. I'm going to present, as African-American literature does, some different images. And one of the suggestions that come, that's up on the post, or on the kiosk, it isn't up on the kiosk, but it's on everywhere else. That's my fault. I meant to cover that and didn't. Last chance to leave. is that when we get a different voice, do we begin to see the world and see others differently? And the fancy word is, it's a paradigm. And we look through, or a lens, and we look through that lens, and most of us have a lens. Lots of us here, not everybody, has a Lutheran lens. Lots of us, not everybody, has a Scandinavian lens. Has a, for sure, I'm looking around, we have a white lens. And white lenses have privileges that black lenses don't have. Okay, let's just run through some of those. And what I'm going to do is to share some of this literature and then ask you, what image do you remember out of the literature? And then what does that specific picture, that image, carry? This is a book called We Are Your Sisters. It's black women in the 19th century. There are lots of slave narratives, autobiographies, written by slaves, but not very many by women. The most famous, I think, is called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Linda Brent, and that's her pseudonym, for her real name is Harriet Jacobs. And we see slavery from very, very different eyes through a woman than we do from a man. And you can imagine why. Your property. And if you're a man, you mow the, you don't mow the lawn. You pick the cotton, you feel the rice, you clean the horses, you cook, the women cook, and what else do the women do? You can imagine that other things, how they have to serve a master. Well, these are some excerpts from that, and they're very brief, and you'll get the sense of what we're trying to do. Now, these are written in dialect, so bear with me on that. When I was a little bitty girl, they used to make a scarecrow out of me. They'd make me get up before daybreak and go out into the cornfields and sit there till way past dark so as to keep the crows from digging up the young corn that was just popping its head above the ground. A heap of mornings the frost bit my feet, and when it come time to go back to the cabin, I could hardly walk. Oh. Images that you remember. Now we're going to leave some of these that are common for us, and that give our world good art does shape and order. What do you remember out of that? I'm going to write it down.
Loneliness.
Fear. Wow.
Pain.
Frozen feet. Now, what carries that? I said frozen feet. I'm sorry. What's the image that brings you to these loneliness, fear, pain, that you understand, I suspect, in a way you maybe hadn't before?
A young girl out in the middle of the field.
Okay, we've got a little girl. She's 8. Out in the field.
Scarecrow image.
A scarecrow.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Just think of the whole story. This is not a test. Her feet.
Frostbitten
feet. Okay, now, and there's more. These are the images. This is what comes out of that and begins to shape our sense of, whoa, life in the 19th century is a little different than what we read about in Little House on the Prairie. So now, other things that come to your mind besides loneliness, fear, and pain?
Subjugation.
Isn't it, though? Great word. Mama, I don't want to. That doesn't matter. There'll be no fighting. Well, let's go. And you take the images, but we'll keep adding to this column. Guess I was a girl about 5 or 6 when I was put with the other children picking out the bugs off the tobacco leaves. Chrissy kept whispering to me to pick them all off. Didn't pay no attention to her. Any that fell off, I just let lay there. Pretty soon, old master come along and see that I'd been missing some of them worms. He picked up a handful of worms, he did, and stuffed them into my mouth. Lordy knows how many of them shiny things I done swallowed, but I sure picked them off careful after that. Over here.
Humiliation.
Wow, you guys are good.
Cruelty.
Keep going.
Yeah. Anger.
Anger. Now, where does anger come? Is she angry? Who said that?
I don't.
Where did that come from?
She's angry. She's angry, but she can't deal with it.
Yeah.
She can't allow it to be expressed.
And the master was angry.
Yeah, the master's angry, and her anger is suppressed. Anybody here angry? When you just kind of feel like, geez, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. like the little northern Minnesota boy that said to his dad, this is wrong. Why don't the Indian kids come out for basketball, Dad? Why don't the Indian kids work on the yearbook? Why don't the Indian kids play football? They're all better athletes than we are in town. Guess what school they came to? Ours. That's interesting, even that word. The Indian kids are going to come into our school, and not we're going to go to Indian.
However false, at her age, there would be a sense of guilt. I done something wrong.
Amen.
Rebellion.
What?
Rebellion.
There was probably a physical sickness when she
ate
those worms.
Yeah, that sure makes sense. Eat worms. This is the 20, or this is the 19th century. We're in the 21st. And one of the things that I think comes out of all African American literature as we tie it together, and we're going to do that through the hour here, is that this is 150 years ago. But there's a legacy that carries with, these images are gone. No little girl gets stuck out in a cornfield anymore. But are there different images that carry these kinds of themes into modern life? We'll see what that is. Just one more. From reading hundreds of slave narratives, I should just tell you that the biggest fear, I won't tell you what the biggest fear was. Imagine what can happen to a slave that's property. I mean, you can escape and they can go get you, like they can go, hey, somebody stole my horse, I'm going to go get it. Somebody took my wagon, I'm going to go get it, and I'm going to bring it back. Whipping, death, stuck it in the field for corn, to be a scarecrow, all kinds of things. Here's the thing that most slaves feared most. Most folks can't remember many things happened to them when they were only 8 years old. But one of my biggest tribulations come about that time, and I never will forget it. That was when I was took away from my mammy and pappy and sent way off 200-300 miles from where I live. And that's the last time I ever see either one of them or any of my own kinfolks. Where I was born was at Hazelhurst, Mississippi. One evening, long come a man and eat supper at the house and stay all night. The next morning, I hear him ask old doctor, what is my name? And old doctor start in to try to sell me to that man. I run away from the house and went out to the cabin where my mammy and pappy was. But they tell me to go back onto the big house because maybe I just scared. But old doctor and the man come. And old doctor make me go with the man. We go in his buggy a long ways off to his house. I ask him how far it is back home. And he say about 100 miles or more and laugh. Image. Or the theme, the value. I mean, you put them on either side. I'll write them for you.
Isolation.
Ah.
Separation.
Well,
you wouldn't feel human, inhuman.
Inhuman again, yes.
Confusion.
Confusion. Maybe you're just scared. He would never do this.
Panic.
Panic. Keep going.
Grief.
What?
Grief.
Grief. Yeah. How about unloved. Trust and what?
Unloved.
Unloved. And the images that carry that? 100 miles. Ran to the cabin. Talked to Mammy. Don't go back. Maybe you're just scared. It wouldn't happen. Maybe you're just scared. What do you make of that? Now, images sometimes are listen images, sound images. Sight images, bare feet in a cornfield. Bare feet in a cornfield. A sound image is, maybe you're just scared. She heard that. What are Mammy and Pappy thinking?
Well, they just accepted the fact they're cattle.
Yeah, that's a great response. And there's a couple that could be there. One of them is, you're just scared, go ahead, we're just cattle. Or, and that's a legitimate reading of it, or it is, they would never do this. They would never sell you. And I don't know if that's the way to read it, or if your ways to read it, but they're both there. That ambiguity is good enough. We know that for sure, trust, and then we've got it up there, fear. Well, there it is. The biggest fear among slaves was that they would be sold. I can tolerate a whipping. I can tolerate my hands in clamps. I can tolerate mosquitoes. I can tolerate frozen feet. But Mama and Papa, and anybody see the video? You guys are about old enough. Roots?
Yeah.
Yes. That was on? The most memorable scene, at least to me, in that whole thing, is when Kizzy gets sold and her mother is crawling in the dirt. And she's been with her daughter's been with her for 20 years and then gets sold. And she's sitting on the back of the wagon waving goodbye and her mother is crawling in the dirt. With tears coming down her face and mixed it in with the dirt, because Kizzy, the daughter, is being sold. And that means gone forever. here's an interesting parallel. In the process of getting teachers to come to Holden, I can't tell you how many times I heard this. I can't be away from my cell phone or my email that long. And it's not only because that's their work. It's that we have all become accustomed to communicating with the people that we love on a pretty regular basis. And when I was, you get the point. So when people would leave their homeland in Europe or wherever and go to the United States, you might not hear from your child for how long? Maybe ever. Or we get that note, John Keats, is the 19th century British poem, has got a whole bunch of letters he wrote to his brother in America, a whole bunch meaning about eight. Eight over about 8 years. And we can't, you know, and we don't want to. My dad is in the, got out of the hospital. I hooked up some email. I called as soon as I got out. This is really hard to not have access. You get the point. And no wonder being sold is the biggest fear of all. Well, we are your sisters. And there are some images that are different and perhaps create a different look at how we, one, consider justice in our country, but also how we look at life in general and our own behavior. Okay, here's one. Just two little poems. This is by, who cares? It's not on the list. His name is County Cullen, but it doesn't matter. But it's, listen to these images. Once, riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now, I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger. And so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. Talk. The image, and this one's sound. That's one of them. Go ahead.
Fright.
Put down.
What?
Put down.
Sure.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerable. I like it. And
from the previous one, that young girl said he laughed at me. So there's derision, just a sense of.
Put down is one level and derision is another. Good. And they're both true.
He saw that other person as a boy, and that boy didn't see him as a boy.
Is it fair then? You're exactly right. This is innocence. I was in Baltimore, my heart, what? Filled with glee. And then.
Smile.
And what did he see? That from May till December. I saw all of Baltimore. All I remember. Anybody been to Baltimore? What's it like?
Beautiful.
Harbors?
Beautiful city.
Beautiful city. Especially now down by on the coast. Yeah, yeah. But that's all that you remember. And I don't know what it was like for County Cullen in 1920. But, well, here's a really modern, well, in modern in the sense of not 2005, but there's a whole series of poets called the Revolutionary Poets who in the 60s and the 70s looked at America with different eyes and tried to analyze our culture and our values with different eyes. And long before that, I wrote it exactly because I want to get it exactly. Way back in the early 50s, Richard Wright said this, "Is it not clear to you that the American Negro is the only group in our nation that consistently and passionately raises the question of freedom?" Is that true? Why would that, you don't know anything about African American literature? Why would that be true? Do we, that's better, raise the question of freedom? Not very often. Do men raise the question of advancement in industry and education? Do women? So who raises the questions? Those who do not benefit from the privilege. So Wright seems to telling us 60 years ago, is it not clear to you that the American Negro is the only group consistently and passionately? And then later he says, if we black folk perish, America will perish. But we are you. So suddenly it isn't just black lit. And suddenly this little kid from northern Minnesota is involved in this whole new paradigm of how do we look at. Now we get into all these words that you guys picked out of these images. we can go into another level and talk about freedom, and talk about self-determination, and talk about autonomy, and talk about courage, and talk about self-definition instead of being defined, on and on and on it goes. Well, here's one of those about self-definition. Donnell Lee is the poet. it's kind of a crazy poem, kind of fun, but it has, I'll read it like he read it. These are called, it's a whole group of poems in the 60s and 70s that are stage poems, and they're really meant not to be just read on the page, but to be listened to, and people stomp their feet, and they read them in gatherings, and this is one of those. Super cool, ultra black, a tan purple head, a beautiful shade. He had a double natural that would put the sisters to shame. His dashikis were tailor-made, and his beads were imported seashells from some black country I never heard of. He was triple hip. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory and came express from the motherland. This is black is beautiful. This is 1960s, 70s, and I'm, you know, pride, black pride, 1968 Olympics. Remember the guys with the fist in the air? This is that time of the year. This is civil rights. This is Watts and Detroit and Newark and Chicago. And when burning, this is Martin Luther King. This is Malcolm X. So we're going to be proud of our blackness, and this guy really is. He's got his African heritage. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory, and it came express from the motherland. He would greet you in Swahili and say goodbye in Yoruba. Woo, Jim, he'd be so cool and intelligent. Cool Cool is so cool. He was uncool, but other black dudes cool. Cool Cool, ultra cool, was bop cool, icebox cool, so cool his wine didn't have to be cool. Him was air-conditioned cool. Cool Cool, real cool, made me cool. Now, ain't that cool? Cool Cool, so cool, him nicknamed Refrigerator. Cool Cool, so cool, he didn't know. After Detroit, Newark, Chicago, Watts, we had the hip. Cool Cool, super cool, real cool. That to be black is to be very hot. What do you hear?
Pride.
Pride. And what about this guy that's got all the stuff? I got my hand-carved tikis, I Swahili greeting, Yoruba, Yoruba, goodbye.
That's kind of fake.
What?
It's kind of fake.
It's kind of fake. And then, you know, you can be cool, black brother, but what? We got to be on the stands in the Olympics with our fist in the air. You got to be hot. We don't want cool. And here's Wright, passionately talking about freedom. And we have, through those images and our laughter, and it's meant to be that, everybody laughed when he said it in the audience, or to the audience too, we get carried into some different sense of self and different sense of how American culture has defined lots of people. Okay, now we get to go into the heavy stuff. And I'll erase and read some literature, good literature, all literature, whether it's African American or European or non-Western, where I won't go because I can't, raises other questions that address values and address humane behavior to everybody, not just blacks. And here are three incidents. I'll read them quickly, and then you tell all of us what sense you get out of these episodes. And also, we've got image and plot both going on, and character. The story here is this little, I'm going to write up here, Sandy, whose real name is James Roger. That doesn't matter. And he's got a little friend. He's 10 years old. Willie May is not his girlfriend, but a friend who's a girl. And Earl is his friend. And Earl is white. Okay. And that's about all we need to know in this story. And except for another character, Harriet. Harriet is his aunt. She's 16. A few weeks ago, she had gone to their class. This is Harriet. Classmates. On tickets issued by the school to see an educational film of the undersea world at the Palace Theater on Main Street. It was a special performance given for the students, and each class had had seats allotted to them beforehand. So Harriet sat with her class and had begun to enjoy immensely the strange wonders of the ocean depths when an usher touched her on the shoulder. The last three rows on the left are for colored, the girl in the uniform said. But I'm with my class. Harriet stammered. We're all supposed to sit here. I can't help it, insisted the usher, pointing towards the rear of the theater while her voice carried everywhere. Them's the house rules. No argument now. You'll have to move. So Harriet rose and stumbled up the dark aisle and out into the sunlight, her slender body hot with embarrassment and rage. The teacher saw her leave the theater without a word of protest, and none of her white classmates defended her for being black. They didn't care. Episode one. Episode two. Sandy, her nephew, 10, is going to be enrolling in his first integrated classroom at fifth grade. "Take seats, all of you, please," the teacher rasped out. "Anywhere now until we get order. Take seats at once." Then the teacher, middle-aged and wearing glasses, I sometimes, not very often anymore, sometimes teach this novel when I ask students, okay, now describe the sense of this. And the middle-aged teacher, "How old is that?" I've got him up to 70 now. Anybody that puts down 40 is out of there. Okay. Then the teacher, middle-aged and wearing glasses, passed out tiny slips of paper to each child in the front row with a command they'd be handed backwards. "Now, write your names on the paper, turning it long ways. Nothing but your names. That's all I want today. You'll receive forms to fill out later. I want to get your seats assigned this morning." They do that. I'm skipping. "Now," she said, "each child rise as I call out your name so I can see who you are." The teacher stood up with the papers in her hand. "Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, Josephine Evans," she called slowly, glancing up after each name. "Franklin Rhodes, James Rogers," is our Sandy. Sandy stood up quickly. "Ethel Shortledge, Roland Thomas," the roll call continued, each child standing until he had been identified, then sitting down again. "Now," the teacher said, "everybody rise and make a line around the walls, quietly, no talking. As I call your names, this time take seats in order, starting with number one in the first row near the window." Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, the roll was repeated, each child taking a seat as she had commanded. When all but four of the children were seated, the two black girls and Sandy still were standing. "Albert Zwick," she said, and the last white child sat down in his place. "Now," said the teacher, "you three colored children, take the seats behind Albert. You, girls, take the first two, and you," pointing to Sandy, "take the last one. Now I'm going to put on the board the list of books to buy, and I want all of you to copy them correctly." Episode two. Last one. For about six pages in the novel, Sandy and Willie Mae and Earl, all the kids in the area are cutting out coupons out of the newspaper so they can go to the carnival and get rides and also get cotton candy and things like that. And it's really a big deal. And there's a reference, in fact, to Willie Mae, the little girl, puts on her brand new shoes and a good dress because this is such a big deal. We wouldn't do that to a carnival, but she does. And that just emphasizes how important this is, and already you can tell what's coming. It was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her shoes and stockings and carried them in her hands until she got near the gate. Then she put them on again and limped bravely along, clutching her precious bits of newspaper, those coupons. They could hear the band playing and children shouting and squealing as the cars on the shoot-the-shoots shot downward with a splash into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel. "I'm going to ride on that first," said Sandy. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park entrance. They were lining up at the gate, laughing, merry, clean little white children, pushing and yelling and giggling amiably. Sandy let Willie Mae go first, and he got in line behind her. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her little black hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry," he said. "This party's for white kids." Willie Mae did not understand. She just stood holding out the coupons, waiting for the tall white man to take them. "Stand back, you two," he said, not unkindly, looking at Sandy as well. "I told you little darkies this wasn't your party. Come on now, next little girl." And the line of white children pushed past Willie Mae and Sandy going into the park. Stunned, the two dark ones drew aside, and then they noticed a group of a dozen or more other black youngsters standing apart in the sun just outside the bright entrance pavilion. And among them was Sadie Butler, Sandy's classmate. Three or four of the children were crying, but most of them looked sullen and angry, and some of them had turned to go home. "My papa takes the leader, and you see what it says here on the coupons, too. Free admittance to every child in Stanton. We can read it, can't we, Sandy?" "Sure, I can read it. But I guess they didn't mean colored. They just wouldn't let us in." Willie Mae, between the painful shoes and the hurt of her disappointment, was on the verge of tears. One of the small boys in the crowd, a hard-looking little fellow from Pearl Street, was cursing childishly. Goddamn old sons of biscuit eaters, that's what they are. I wish I was a big man, doggone. I'd shoot them all, that's what I'd do. I suppose they didn't mean black kids, said Sandy. Buster went in all right, said Sadie. I seen him, but he's pretty light. They didn't know he was colored, I guess. When I went up to the gate, the man just said, whoa, where are you going? Just like I was a horse. Remember this line. I'm going home now and tell my papa. She walked away, followed by five or six other little girls. Then Sandy saw his white schoolmate, Earl, approaching. What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in? Did Willie Mae hurt her foot? No, said Sandy. We just ain't going in. Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you get more lemonade. So you take them. The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, then went on into the park. Any thoughts? Either images, actions that are created by images, and then our feelings.
Pain.
So in this column, kids are crying?
Not fair.
Anticipation.
And then
disappointment. Humiliation.
That leads to humiliation.
Acceptance.
Rejection.
And rejection.
Anger.
And anger. Goddamn those sons of biscuit eaters.
Bewilderment.
And bewilderment. She just stood there. Remember that? What a great image, huh? What? So that's over here. And the what carries that is just holding the tickets. And we don't need to talk about those, because we do in the next stage, it's even deeper. The holding the tickets, these are, and they're all the images that you can think of that carry this. Well, what else is carried there?
But Sandy accepted it.
Oh, that's a great point. He did accept it. I guess they didn't mean black kids. So what do you make of that? This kid. Yeah, good. So it's one thing. Some kids fight. Some kids just give up.
Don't you think he was also sparing his white friend?
He's what?
Sparing his white friend.
Isn't that interesting? And for sure he doesn't. Now he's 10. Earl's the guy's name. He's sparing Earl. Aren't you going in? No. Here, you take my tickets. Did Sandy hurt her foot? No, you take my tickets. What do you make of that?
And then he didn't want his friend to feel bad, so he didn't tell him why.
And could he tell him why? How do you explain when you're 10?
Yeah.
Sit down, Earl. Let me give you a little talk about, you know, institutional racism. Or sit down, Earl. Let me talk about bigotry.
It would be the admission of the reality of it.
Wow.
If he were to try to explain that.
Now we're getting into, and all good literature goes there. You know, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, Earl, and at the age that they are, I mean, maybe this is naive on my part, but children don't see each other as black and white. And maybe that's kind of what was going on, in a sense.
Yeah.
Earl wasn't even thinking of them as being black, and maybe part of that was going on too. And that, maybe that's why they couldn't understand it quite.
Sure. And I'll put down there this innocence that's there from Earl. C-E-N-C-E. Yeah. And we got 10. And you bring up, thank you, it's a great secretary into what we want to look at. Because you think you're dead right. How about this usher at the theater? We don't know, but how old? Make it up.
16.
Teenager. So we got 15, 16 or so. So I'm going to put that down here. 15, 17. Be careful now. How old is the teacher?
Middle-aged.
That's a chicken response.
We think 30. 70 is good.
30? Who said that? You're out of here. Okay, well, what do we say, 50?
55.
Okay, 55. And then we look at that scale of time and age and innocence, and if we look at I think all literature does this one way or another, it's spelled out clearly in 19th century British poets talk about the human journey from innocence to experience and maybe to a higher kind of innocence. This is a language, whoever cares, it's a language of a guy named William Blake, and the only person to William Blake's mind, this great 19th century poet, the only guy that ever achieved higher innocence was Jesus. And he's a radical kind of Christian. But anyway, we're going to move from innocence to experience and then maybe make some sense out of our experiences. At what point should they be responsible, aware? I wouldn't either. You don't expect Earl and Sandy to get the complexity of racism. And racism, you know, in a simple kind of way, breaks down. It's complex, but the language is simple. It can be attitudinal, and which is in a way more like bigotry. And it can be institutional. It's institutional that says, this is what the canon, this is the literature you need to study to be a master's degree in American literature. So the attitudinal, the institutional racism overlap. So we don't expect 10. What about 15?
Yeah.
I mean, what about 15? And where do you put that line? Can we put a spot? It should be right there. Or it should be right there. Or where is that? And what is it that brings that about?
Somewhere in there, there's the denial.
So in this whole process, I like that. I was in South Africa several years ago, and the first person I met getting off the plane, she got me off the black people after that. This woman was white. She was 62 years old, and she said, how many people have seen the video Cry Freedom? You heard of that? It's the story of Stephen Biko, the protest kid and doctor in medical school who protested and got beaten to death in the jail cell. She saw that video just the night before she picked me up. Now, 62. Lived in South Africa all her life. She is South African. She said, and no one else from America, and figuring, okay, they're coming here to see what apartheid's like. I shouldn't say they. I was all alone. Come and see what apartheid is like. And so on. She said, you know, I saw Cry Freedom last night, and I had no idea. Now, 62 years in living in South Africa and not know. Well, she dropped me off at where I from then was with black people, and I told them that story. And this is what made me think of this. The woman that first took me out into the desert to see housing and churches and the work that they were doing with water and so on, you'd have to try not to know. Mm-hmm. So we do deny it, and we can look at our government and kind of what Katrina brought out, right? We've denied the existence of another kind of existence. And so it's a great word to put somewhere in this progress from 10 to whenever. When are we expected to know?
Would personal experience be part of that also?
Sure. And that means that if you don't live around black people, it's okay and you don't have to know. But it's one way to know is to live, yeah. Here's the English teacher talking. Another way is we can take a look at some stuff and read. And we can watch John DeGraff's videos, documentaries, and on it goes. Well, anybody else, anything about this journey that we're seeing? And the question then comes out of the literature. It's not just about images that create a new vision for us. Now the images are asking for some kind of response from a reader. And I don't know a writer who doesn't write expecting some kind of active response from what they write. When I was in college, we used to always have this debate among the English majors in class. Is art political? Well, in college it was a nice debate, and now I'm thinking, what a stupid question. Of course. And there isn't one that isn't. One piece of literature that isn't somehow political that affects how we respond and act in our lives with other people. Well, we've got a few minutes to go one step further with images in one of the really great African-American novels in America is Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. And the characters you need to know are Pilate, and she has a daughter. No, we're not going to introduce. Yeah, we are too. She has a daughter named Reba, and she has a daughter named Hagar, or Hagar. I say Hagar, I don't know. And then Pilate has a brother, and his name is Macon. And Macon has a son, and he's called Milkman, nickname. Pilate is, who cares, but she is my favorite character in all of American literature. She is absolutely the most radical looking, the most radical acting person, more so than Huck Finn when he says, then I'll go to hell if I have to turn my slave friend in. Here's Tony, or here is Pilate. And I think I can do this in 6 minutes and let you respond to it. Her brother has this attitude about life. He says to his son, who's a teenager, you stay away from Pilate. She is just too weird. I don't want you around her. Pilate wears men's shoes. They're unlaced. She eats only when she feels like it. She doesn't cook any meals. She doesn't have any windows in her house. Well, you'll get more about her. And she is a wonderful character that we don't get very well acquainted with in 8 minutes. But Macon says to Milkman about Pilate and about what you better pay attention to. Boy, you got better things to do with your time than go visit his aunt. Boy, you got better things to do with your time besides this time you started to learn how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office. Work a couple of hours there and learn what's real. You gave me that word, and I erased it, but I didn't want to. Real. And it's really kind of a metaphysical concept now, that what is real? And well, to this guy, and by the way, the symbol, the image that's in the book that for Milkman, he carries this chain of keys on his pocket. And he holds them in his hand. He fondles them. He just holds them all the time because these are his keys and these are the symbol of his ownership, of his power. And they're the image that represents all that Milkman is. Okay, back to Pilate. You come to my office, work a couple of hours and learn what's real. Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. So is the next world, and we're not talking, I mean, you know what he means, but there's a different reality. And that's the radical vision that we're going to see in a second. That maybe, let me tell you right now the one important thing you'll ever need to know. Own things. And let the things you own other things. And then you'll own yourself and other people too. And starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. Ever heard that before? Own things. Stuff. Affluenza. You'll get a chance to see it this week. It's the sickness of our affluence and how unhappy we are as Americans. The more we buy, the less happy. We think it's going to help. We know about that, right? So Macon's got this, I'm going to own stuff. And that's his reality. Pilate lives in a completely different world. It seems to me that Jesus did too. Sell all you have. Every time I think about that, I say, my boat too? I mean, I can't go. Okay. Well, here's Pilate. When she first meets Milkman, Milkman comes with his friend, and it's his first time being in Pilate's house, and Reba and Hagar are there. It's a real short scene, and you'll get it. Hagar, now, get this out, better back up. Pilate is the sister of Macon, therefore she is the aunt of Milkman, right? Therefore, Reba and Hagar are cousins. Okay, good. Hagar, Pilate looked around the room. This here's your brother, Milkman, and this is his friend. What's your name again, pretty? Guitar. I didn't put him up there, but that's just a friend that Milkman came with. Guitar, you play any? She asked. That ain't her brother, Mama. They cousins, the older woman spoke. Same thing. No, it ain't, is it, baby? No, said Hagar. It's different. See there? It's different. Well, what is the difference, Reba? You know so much. Reba looked at the ceiling. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother or if you both, Pilate interrupted her. And I'm going to read that again and not say Pilate interrupted her. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother or if you both, I mean, what's the difference in the way you act toward them? Don't you have to act the same way to both? That's not the point, Mama. What do you say about Pilate? A brother. I met 15 brothers of the woman who took me around into the deserts of Namibia. They weren't her brothers. But don't you have to act the same way to both? Well, here's now where literature takes us to a completely different paradigm, and the black writer sets us up, Toni Morrison. Pilate is fiction now, is born without a navel. And because she is ostracized by everybody. And they think, whoa, this is some kind of a witch. And she has one sexual encounter with the guy who together they created Reba. And when he saw her the next morning, he said, whoa, are you some kind of mermaid? And he took off. Man. So now she knows she's never going to have intimate relationships, and she's isolated by the community. And here's what the narration says about Pilate. Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, she's not educated, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. Sell all you have. Love me more than your brother, your sister, your mother. Cut away every assumption. So we have a whole set of assumptions, the way this little session started, because of the images that we confront and have confronted our whole life. But now Pilate's going to, okay, throw away every assumption and begin at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad and what is the difference? Again, I refer you, affluenza. When am I happy? Why, because I got 4 boats and 6 cars and a 4-car garage, and I'm not happy. When am I happy? When am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What's true in the world? She gave up, apparently, all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. The last little episode to read suggests that she lives in a completely different world. And it, again, it's fiction, but it tells a great truth. And she's telling about the time that she, when they were little, Pilate and Macon got along great. And they were in the woods after their papa had been shot off a fence, killed, because he had been too successful. The black man can't be successful. And here's this last episode. Now we was lost, and there was this wind, and in front of us was the back of our daddy. He was already dead. We were some scared children. Macon kept telling me the things we were scared of wasn't real. But what difference do it make if the thing you're scared of is real or not? I remember doing laundry for a man and his wife once down in Virginia. The husband came into the kitchen one afternoon shivering and saying, did I have any coffee made? I asked him what it was that had grabbed hold of him. He looked so bad. He said he couldn't figure it out, but he felt like he was about to fall off a cliff. Standing right there on that yellow and white and red linoleum, as level as flat iron. He was holding on to the door first, then the chair, trying his best not to fall down. I opened my mouth to tell him there wasn't no cliff in that kitchen. And then I remembered how it was being in those woods. I felt it all over again. So I told the man, did he want me to hold on to him so he couldn't fall? He looked at me with the most grateful look in the world. Would you? He said. I walked around back of him and locked my fingers in front of his chest and held on to him. His heart was kicking under his vest like a mule in heat, but little by little it calmed down. You saved his life. No, he's talking to Guitar and Milkman. You saved his life, said Guitar. No such thing. His wife came in before it was time to let go. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her. Told her what? What'd you say? The truth, that I was trying to keep him from falling off a cliff. I bet he wished he had jumped off then. She believed you? Don't tell me she believed you. Well, not right away she didn't. But soon as I let go, he fell dead weight to the floor. Smashed his glasses and everything. Fell right on his face. And you know what? He went down so slow, I swear it took 3 minutes. 3 whole minutes to go from a standing upright position to when he mashed his face on the floor. I don't know if that cliff was real or not, but it took him 3 minutes to fall down it. Was he dead? Eschatar? Stone dead. There's a world of reality there, and in my own mind, the woman comes in, and the world of reality is that she's standing behind her husband holding him up, and there's no imagination, there's no possibility of another world, of another kind of reality that, that Pilate did see, right? Can I hold you? Can I help you? As opposed to, there's no... So a woman who sees another reality, either whether it's the power of her imagination or if it's her ability to look through a different lens and connect to somebody on a completely different level than own things, this is the stuff that matters, or whatever other lenses we might pull or look at the world through. One phrase, and we're done, that literature sends to us a lot, a theme, is called death in life. So who's really alive? Those of us, and you can put that in, is the guy at the gate really alive? No, you can't go in here. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to act about it. Just you can't get into the carnival. Sit back there. Does she have to think? Does she have to live? Does she have to encounter? Who's really alive? Well, all of these images that we've been seeing in our own life, and now we get some different ones, gives us a different paradigm, gives us a different lens through which to try to understand other people and life. Anybody have anything to say? Any good books you want to recommend?
I was just thinking of when you talk about relationships, and Jesus' words, "Who are my brothers and sisters?"
Yep, great.
And there's a whole new definition of
that's a whole family. Yeah, it's a whole new definition, and you can put that and impose that on any kind of political structure we have today, and the geopolitics and the foreign policies and all kinds of things that fit a different kind of lens. Thank you.
It's my understanding that in the African culture, there is no word for uncle. That is, they're all brothers.
Yeah. Well, that sure makes sense. I've never heard it put that way, but that's what I saw, and that's what she says, too. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Well, have a good day. You've been wonderful. You all got A's. Thank you.